From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome everyone to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Varicose veins and peripheral artery disease, two common blood vessel problems. One is cosmetic, the other a sign of a more serious condition. We'll find out which one requires treatment.
People live on the average longer, maybe as much as 7 years longer when they have varicose veins than if they don't. It turns out that people who make varicose veins are better at making other kinds of blood vessels. You want to find a bunch of old people, you go find people who've got varicose veins.
Also on the program, advice on how you can get more out of your next healthcare visit.
And restless leg syndrome. It's a common cause of insomnia.
All that along with this week's health and medical news right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Well, they always show up uninvited and like unwelcome company, they're usually hard to get rid of. We're talking about varicose veins, those gnarled, enlarged veins that most often appear on your legs and feet.
For most people, varicose veins are just largely a cosmetic concern, but for some, varicose veins can cause aching and discomfort, and occasionally they can lead to serious problems. Here to talk about varicose veins, what causes them, and how they're treated is Dr. Tom Rook. Dr. Rook is a specialist in cardiovascular diseases at Mayo Clinic. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Rook. We're glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Tom. Good to have you. So they're unsightly, and they usually come on with age. What causes these things? Why do our veins bulge out when we get older?
Well, you know, this is something we don't always know the answer to. Probably the biggest answer is that it's genetics, people who develop varicose veins have a tendency to get varicose veins from their ancestors here. But we do know that there's a lot of other additional factors that can contribute. Everything from prolonged standing to obesity, to blood clots that may have occurred in the veins in the past. All of these things can lead to the development of varicose veins.
Is it why I don't want to cross my legs?
Well, don't cross your legs. That's a little bit of an old wives' tale.
I knew it!
The varicose veins are actually, I tell women, are in fact hereditary. You get them from your kids because, you know, that's, I always hear that, you know, Doc, I had beautiful legs till baby one, baby two, baby three, and now look at them. So, you know, the reason you get them isn't always necessarily straightforward. The other thing is that there seems to be a very definite relationship between varicose veins and hormones. You know, the three times that, for example, in a woman's life that she'll get varicose veins are first at puberty. You really don't get varicose veins before puberty. Second time you get them, and you get them with a vengeance, is during pregnancy when the hormones, when the estrogens and progesterones are typically elevated. But curiously, the third time that you tend to form them, especially spider veins, is around the perimenopausal period. And we make a joke that's not really a joke, that every hot flash gives you a new spider vein. It's sort of, you know, not
I
true.
I do not think that is funny at all, sir.
Exactly.
And I shouldn't have laughed.
Except that it certainly seems that way for a lot of patients.
But is it weakening of the wall of the vein?
You know, this used to be a classic theory, was that it was a weakening of the wall of the vein, a degeneration, and I think in some cases it's probably still okay to think about them that way. It might be a little more complicated, and it might actually have a good lesson there at the end. And I don't know how much of this you necessarily want to hear, but we've been looking into this. You would think that if varicose veins were just due to degeneration or weakening of the blood vessel, gosh, I have veins everywhere. If they're weakening and falling apart in my legs and my skin, what's going on in my heart? What about my brain? What about my kidneys? Well, we've been looking at cohorts of patients with and without varicose veins that seem similarly matched. And when we look at what happens to them over time, we actually find just the opposite of what you're describing. People in and around Olmsted County live on the average longer, maybe as much as 7 years longer when they have varicose veins than if they don't.
What? How can that be?
Well,
that doesn't seem to make any sense.
It turns out that your body probably wants to manufacture some of these veins, particularly the little spider veins. When you see those, that's a sign that the body really wants to make blood vessels, that it's good at making blood vessels. It turns out that people who are good at making blood vessels may make them down in your legs, where you don't want them, but God forbid, if you get that hardening of the arteries, PAD, other problems where you start to lose blood vessels, people who make varicose veins are better at making other kinds of blood vessels. So they'll make what we call collateral blood vessels, vessels that can form around a blocked blood vessel. They seem to be better at that. And as a result, they seem to have less heart attacks, less strokes, less other problems. You want to find a bunch of old people, you go find people who've got varicose veins and they seem indestructible.
Instead of looking down at your varicose veins and saying, oh, thanks, Mom, and thanks, Grandma, you should say, thank you.
Well, we're still looking at that. That's exactly right. But they may be a curse and a blessing.
Unbelievable. Never had heard that before. And you've just research you've recently done.
Yeah, this is stuff that's still coming out. It's really, you know, too premature to, you know, be able to give you numbers and things. But this is, there's other things in the literature that support this point of view. So it's not something we're making up.
So other than the fact that if you've got a varicose vein, you're probably going to live longer, they're not a functional problem, are they? I mean, is it purely cosmesis that bothers people about them?
Sometimes. That's clearly the biggest problem is going to be cosmesis. People don't like the way they look. People don't like veins in general. You know, veins in the skin are a normal thing. We need them. If we don't have them, we swell. We can't get blood back to our hearts. And yet nobody likes looking down at their hands or their arms or their feet and seeing veins of any type, whether they're varicose or not.
Well, you can zap these things now, can't you?
We can.
Tell us how you do that.
Yeah, we can fix veins that aren't working right. Varicose veins are veins that aren't working. They're swamps. The blood's just kind of pooling in them at this point. And if we have to fix them, we've got a number of ways we can do it. Everybody's familiar with stripping. We all have an Aunt Matilda who had stripping, and she'll always tell you it was the worst thing that ever happened in her life. They used to be horrible operations. They're not nearly so bad anymore. In fact, most of the stripping things we can do are just simple outpatient procedures.
And what exactly were you doing when you're stripping someone's veins?
When you strip someone's veins, you're gonna make a little tiny cut in the skin. We call it a stab. It's sometimes so small you don't even have to put a stitch in the little cut to close it up. But you make a little stab over the vein, you can reach in with a hook, and you can pull out a segment of the vein. And by running along the vein with a little series of stabs, you can go ahead and remove the vein.
You just take it out.
Now, the second big way that we get rid of veins is with, you know, our new technology here. Everybody has heard of laser therapy for veins. You know, it's probably the number one question I get asked. There is nothing sexier than laser for treating anything.
Anything.
Right. The way laser is done for the veins, we have a couple of types. We have a kind of a laser that we can shine on the skin that's good for getting rid of these little spider veins. We really don't use it as widely across the body as you might think. It's mostly reserved at the Mayo practice for small spider veins on the face. The other way we use laser, though, is as a substitute for stripping when it comes to the really big veins of the leg. We have a couple of veins, one in particular called the great saphenous vein, which is the longest vein in the body, and it's got a terrible propensity to become varicose. When that happens, instead of having to make 10 or 15 or 20 little cuts to remove it, we can puncture the patient maybe down around the calf or the ankle with a needle, slide a catheter up this vein we want to get rid of, and once we got it all the way into the vein, we can pull it back slowly but cauterize it shut by shining a laser beam through it, burn it shut from within. And this is great. It's an outpatient procedure. You put the leg in a compression stocking, patient gets up, you kiss them goodbye, and they're off walking, shopping at the mall, eating at a restaurant. They don't really want to shovel snow or cut the lawn for a couple days. But now the last way that we treat varicose veins is with a technique that I do a lot of. It's called sclerotherapy, and it involves injecting a caustic material into the veins that will irritate them, and by irritating them, you inflame them and cause them to close down and scar off.
They give up. Whatever that poison was.
They don't like it. The secret of a good sclerotherapy agent, you've hit a key word, poison. Oh my God, are you going to put a poison in my body? Well, you know, it's a poison that is specifically only harmful at a high concentration, not harmful at a low concentration. So it can go into the vein, cause damage, and then when it mixes with some blood and moves back into your bloodstream, it becomes harmless. I'll give you a good example of one that we can use. Alcohol. You know, alcohol injected into a vein at a high concentration is deadly. But I don't know, Shives, have you ever had any alcohol in your blood at a low concentration? Is this, you know,
it's all right?
It's not dangerous at a low concentration.
So what happens? Do those vessels then, does that varicose vein just dissolve over time and go away? Is it absorbed into the skin?
Exactly. Okay. What it does is, you know, a vein is a tube, a little hollow pipe, and by inflaming it, it'll first clot off, and then it'll, as the inflammation goes away, it scars down. So it goes from being a little pipe to maybe being a thread or a guitar string.
All right, Dr. Tom Rook, we don't strip him anymore. We got several good ways to treat varicose veins. He is a blood vessel specialist at the Mayo Clinic.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about another vascular problem, peripheral artery disease, or PAD. Unlike varicose veins, PAD can be a sign of serious circulatory problems.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. We are back with Mayo Clinic cardiovascular specialist Dr. Tom Rook, Mayo Clinic Rochester. Well, unlike varicose veins, peripheral arterial disease, or PAD, can be a sign of serious cardiovascular disease, something really seriously wrong with your heart or blood vessels. Dr. Rook, just what is PAD?
Well, everybody's familiar with the atherosclerotic blockages that can affect the heart and give us heart attacks, or the kind that can affect the vessels of the neck and the brain and might give us a stroke. It turns out that those problems, these what we call plaques, or areas of cholesterol and calcium deposition, not only occur in the heart and the brain, but they can occur everywhere in the body. And one of the most common places for them to occur is in the vessels of the arteries of the legs, or the arteries leading to the legs. And when they take place there, we call it peripheral artery disease.
All right. So it's like hardening of the arteries in any part of the body. In this case, it just happens to be peripheral to the central part. It's not the central part of the body. It's the leg.
That's where the term comes from. But it really can refer, I think, to any disease that's not in the heart or the brain. So we also call kidney problems related to atherosclerosis peripheral artery disease. We call problems in the intestines, if you were to get it, that would be a peripheral artery disease. But usually it's the legs, and very rarely, in fact, is it in the arms.
Yeah. I was just going to say, if not the legs, why not the arms?
Yeah, we don't really know. Nobody quite understands exactly why plaques build up in blood vessels exactly where they do. Why do we get them in the heart and the brain and the legs so commonly and so rarely in other blood vessels?
Well, yeah, the good news is you've got pretty good treatment for PAD of the legs, the lower extremities. But the bad news is that if your legs are affected, it's likely that other parts of your body, like your brain or your heart, are also affected, correct?
That's exactly correct. In fact, there are many, many societies, many individuals who advocate that if a person wants to find out whether or not they've got problems with hardening of the arteries, the cheapest, fastest, easiest, least invasive way to test that is to measure the blood pressure down in the ankles. You can compare that to the pressure in the arms, and if there's a difference, we call this the ankle brachial index test. That's one of the best predictors we have for whether a person has atherosclerosis.
Really? What about if you can palpate the arteries in your foot?
Well, that's always a good sign. If you can palpate them, chances are they're normal or very close to normal. The fact that you can't palpate them, I don't want to worry people.
Do you guys
too
mean
much
that you can feel them or not
feel them? Yes,
okay,
that's what
good
we mean. If you
palpate.
Can if you can feel a pulse down in the feet, that's a good sign. If you can't find it, sometimes there's other reasons why you can't feel it. There may be a lot of tissue covering it, but it can still be normal in some cases.
All right, so for people who are taking their shoe and their sock off right now, explain to us where there's one artery on the top of the foot and there's another just behind what we call the medial malleus on the inner side of the foot behind that bony
prominence. That bulgy ankle bone is the key landmark there. If you feel right behind it, between that and your heel, and you press lightly enough, you should be able to feel your pulse. Same thing on the top of your foot. If you go about two-thirds of the way between the base of your toes and the ankles, and you feel around, say, between those long bones, between the first and second long bones, you'll often be able to feel your pulse.
Yep. Okay. And that's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
What are some of the signs of PAD or symptoms that patients might have?
Well, it really depends on how severe it is. It can be anything from asymptomatic. Most people are going to be asymptomatic. They won't know they have it. But as it becomes more severe, as the blockages get worse, the first thing that typically brings the patient to your attention is that they have difficulty walking. When they walk, their legs begin to cramp up. So what happens is they've got plenty of blood flow getting there at rest, but not enough to let them perform. The word for that is claudication. It's a Latin word that means to limp, because so many people who claudicate, that's what happens, is they start to walk funny the farther they walk. They begin to limp.
If people have PAD and they're starting to have trouble walking, do they also have pain, or do they just have trouble walking?
Well, they can have trouble walking, but pain is an absolute thing that we look for. The pain typically begins when you walk a certain distance, and people can very easily reproduce this distance. They'll tell you, I walk one block or two blocks or three blocks, and then I get the pain. When they stop, the pain typically disappears in about 1 to 3 minutes, and then they're able to move on again.
What can patients do to relieve the PAD? Is there medications they take, or what do you do to help patients?
All right, well, there's three major ways that you're going to treat PAD. There's actually several ways. You'd like to reduce your cardiac risk factors. So you've got to lower your cholesterol and your hypertension and watch your diabetes. That's the first thing that you want to do. The second thing that you think about are specific medications. And we do have a couple of medications that may help. They really work by making your blood more slippery so it can slip through these blockages a little easier. The third thing is that you can try to open up the blockages where they occur. And this can be done with balloon catheters or these little metal tubes we call stents, or when necessary, it can be done with surgery and the arteries can be cleaned out or they can be bypassed. But I got to make a point here that the biggest thing that people like me typically recommend for folks who are having pain when they walk is that you need to exercise. You know, a little earlier we talked about this idea that you can grow new blood vessels around blocked ones. And it turns out that many people, if they simply exercise through their pain, rest, exercise through their pain again, rest, and by exercise I mean walk, this will stimulate the body to grow collateral blood vessels, little new blood vessels around the blockages. And this has been shown time and time again to be the most effective way of treating the pain with walking that you get from PAD.
Are we really at the point you talked about doing to the leg arteries the same thing you can do to the heart, that is balloon the blood vessel, enlarge it, put a stent in there to hold it open, which is like the spring in a ballpoint pen. But you can also, aren't you getting closer to being able to actually go in there with a Roto-Rooter and clean out the blood vessels, or are we there yet?
Well, we're not there yet. Yes, we do have all kinds of gizmos and gadgets that go in there. The problem is that while we can get these vessels open, it's the body has a great knack for closing them back up again. So that's really the big problem. We get them open, but we can't keep them open.
All right, blood vessel expert, Dr. Tom Rook from the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Thanks so much.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll have advice on how to get more out of your next visit with your doctor. It's all part of the Patient Revolution Project.
And restless leg syndrome. It's uncomfortable and annoying, and it can rob you of sleep.
Have a health-related question you'd like us to answer or a topic you'd like us to cover? You can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio or send an email to mayoclinicradio@mayo.edu.
Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
How much running does it take to improve your health? I'm Vivian Williams with your Mayo Clinic Minute. Well, you don't have to put in as many miles as you might think. New research shows if you run 6 miles a week, you can add 3 to 6 years on your life. Mayo Clinic sports medicine specialist Dr. Edward Laskowski says,
if you get out there and get moving, you're going to benefit your body, your heart and lung system, as well as protection from certain cancers.
Now, what does periodontitis, or inflamed shrinking gums, mean to your heart? Apparently, a lot. Researchers from Sweden say it's linked to the buildup of plaque in your arteries. They want to find ways to diagnose and treat both issues. Now, speaking of your mouth, a European study shows smokers are more than 3 times more likely to lose their teeth than non-smokers. Their gums may appear healthy, but they're not. Another reason to try to quit smoking. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW for help. For more health news, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Stop and think about it a moment. Have you ever left your doctor's office wishing you'd brought something up, asked another question, been more direct about what you wanted? Well, if you're like most people, your answer is probably yes.
Most of us, maybe because we're afraid of appearing pushy or less than intelligent, or because we don't want to be a burden to a busy caregiver, have not been as open or as direct as we maybe would have liked to have been during our doctor visit.
The lack of openness and communication can adversely affect the relationship between the patient and their doctor. And that can lead to inappropriate treatment and non-compliance, not doing what your doctor told you to do, which can also interfere with successful care.
There's an initiative called the Patient Revolution Project that's trying to get at the nuts and bolts of the patient-caregiver relationship in an effort to make it more effective. Maggie Breslin is the creative director of the Patient Revolution Project, and she joins us in our studio here along with Dr. Victor Montori. Dr. Montori is an endocrinologist at Mayo Clinic, a medical director of the Patient Revolution Project, and a frequent guest here on Mayo Clinic Radio. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Maggie, Dr. Montori, thanks so much for being with us. Say, Maggie, I have to ask you. It says you are on your website, you're a designer, you're a researcher, and you're a writer, and you have a unique background in healthcare delivery. So when did you then get interested in improving the doctor-patient relationship, and what was wrong with it? What is wrong with it?
Well, I think you learn very quickly when you start doing research on any number of topics, any number of healthcare topics, that physician-patient communication, how they talk to each other, what they talk about, is at the root of good care. And if you can focus in and try and improve and create systems that are primarily about supporting and encouraging meaningful dialogue between those two people in that room, then the ripple effects can transform healthcare in incredible ways. So it was a common theme that we kept seeing over and over. It was a topic that we were able to explore a lot in our work with Victor around shared decision making and minimally disruptive medicine. And as we kind of grew and were able to kind of work together, we recognized that, wow, we were getting the opportunity to build a lot of different tools and interventions, primarily from the clinical side. And we had this idea in the back of our heads, like, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could build up a similar program that was developing tools and innovations, but primarily to put in the hands of patients for them to bring into their clinical encounters.
So teaching patients, well, I was going to say teaching patients to be better patients, but that's not quite right.
It's not quite right, because sometimes when we define better patients, what we mean by that is better patients as defined by the clinical community. It often means, how do we get patients to do what we would like them to do? And I think that the reality is patients live complex lives. Healthcare is ambiguous and messy, and that a lot of the role of the clinical community is to help patients navigate what options may be available to them so that they can live the best life they possibly can with the least impact from the solutions that we put out there.
So when we think about compliance, we think about patients acting in their own best interest, guided by the clinician. And the problem is that in particularly for complex patients or living in complex situations, what's best for them is something that is not immediately obvious just starting from the medical knowledge. One has to understand the knowledge about their lives. And even patients who have bought into the program and the program actually fits their current circumstance can be derailed by life. And so a patient of mine that was doing very well in terms of her diabetes all of a sudden begins to deteriorate in their ability to take care of themselves. And when you start exploring why that might be the case, you find out that they're having significant problems at home, financial problems, difficulties at work, etc. And so those things now have changed the circumstances in which the treatment has to work, and the treatment no longer fits. The ability to communicate with patients and for patients to express those issues and find that it's valid to bring those issues into the consultation is something we're trying to move forward with the Patient Revolution Project.
Oh, I totally understand that. Best circumstances may change, or the treatment that you prescribe may be very difficult for the patient. But how do you change that?
Well, so the idea behind the Patient Revolution Project is to advance tools and interventions that help patients be able to share that knowledge with the clinician before the decision has been made. So to be able to recognize, I have a lot of things going on in my life, or these are the things that I'm really thinking about as I think about how do I get a solution or a treatment for this particular condition or issue that I have, and to be able to share that information about their lives with the physician at the beginning or at the first consultation that they have, so that the recommendations that come are already taking that piece of information into account. So it's really about how can we encourage and support patients in sort of proactively sharing information with their clinician about their lives so that can impact the care plan.
We've seen many patients who, and we've talked to many patients who have told us that they think that bringing such issues into the consultation is not pertinent. That they're, and maybe they learned that from our faces or how we respond to when they actually do. But the truth is, they don't know that it is pertinent to bring up issues of their home life, their work situation, their financial issues into the consultation, or that they're gonna represent a big burden on the clinician, or is gonna waste their time, and so they edit themselves and they just don't bring those issues up. Part of the work that we're doing is to say no. If we don't, as clinicians, we don't know about that, we're gonna get the treatment wrong, and we're not gonna be able to address your needs.
Just before we started, you said it's more about push than pull. Mm-hmm. Explain what that means when it comes to patients.
Yeah, a lot of healthcare innovation that we do is a pull mechanism. How do we help the clinic and the institution pull important information from the patient, which we can then use to create care plans or advance care? The Patient Revolution Project is a push model. How can we teach and skill and support patients in terms of pushing the information at the clinician and say, here's something important about me that you need to know and that I want you to consider when you're thinking about how to treat me for this particular issue? And that we think ultimately that the combination of the push and the pull that's happening within any clinical encounter can lead to the best possible outcome. One of the parts of tools and skilling is to teach people to be able to get to the point more quickly, to be able to isolate the things that are most important to them, and then that makes it actually, the back and forth exchange happens much more quickly. And that's something that we have seen oftentimes in use with the tools and certainly with the shared decision-making tools. I also think it's you have to potentially change the scale at which you're thinking about efficiency. So yes, you can bring a patient in every 3 months for a 10-minute visit and get them in and out. But if you find that they're not really meeting their goals and they're not really achieving the type of care that you would like them to have, then that's ultimately inefficient. So if we can think about it more in terms of years or at a much higher scale efficiency, I think if you have a meaningful conversation with a patient early on in a relationship with them, and then you can use that knowledge and that building rapport that you've had to continue making sure that the care plan that you're creating fits into their lives, that's ultimately a much more efficient way of delivering healthcare. And perhaps even more importantly than that, it's a much more caring and kind way of being to deliver healthcare. And it's one that's going to be more meaningful to the patient and actually more meaningful to the clinician.
Maggie Breslin is the creative director of the Patient Revolution Project. Thanks for coming and telling us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for Dr. Victor Montori as well.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, restless leg syndrome. It's an uncontrollable urge to move your legs, and it's a major cause of insomnia.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shines.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Restless leg syndrome, or RLS. It's a condition where you have this uncontrollable urge to move your legs. It's usually due to discomfort. Your legs may throb, or they ache, or there might be the pulling, creeping, or other unpleasant sensation. RLS typically occurs in the evening or at night when you're sitting or lying down or when you're ready to go to bed. Moving your legs can ease the discomfort temporarily in most people.
Restless leg syndrome can occur at any age, even, Tom, in children.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and in serious cases, it can lead to insomnia and depression. Here to explain RLS and how it's treated is sleep disorders specialist Dr. Suresh Kadigal. Welcome to the program, Dr. Kadigal. It's great to have you back.
Oh, thanks so much, Tracy.
Dr. Kadigal, it's a strange phenomenon, isn't it? And actually, not all that uncommon. I think I recently read that it can affect, some have estimated that it affects up to 10% of the population.
Yes, you know, in the adults, it's far more common, and you're right, it may affect about 10% of the adult population. In children, there are good studies to indicate, there's studies from U.S. and United Kingdom, that about 2% of all children can have restless leg syndrome. Now, when we compare to attention deficit disorder, which is another common school-related condition, that has about a 5% prevalence. So RLS is up there.
Pretty common. What about men versus women?
There's a slight female predominance. I think young women would probably more likely to get restless legs than men. Whereas in children, it seems to be equally prevalent, both boys and girls.
Is there any difference in between restless leg syndrome and what I seem to notice as I'm falling asleep at night, that one of my legs will twitch? Is it the same line, or is it a completely different thing?
It's different, because we all have those jerks or startles, the one or two jerks of the body as we are drifting off to sleep. And those are also called hypnic starts.
And hypnic?
Yes,
hypnic. H-Y-P.
N-I-C.
Hypnic. Or you got the hypnic.
So related to just falling asleep. And that is actually a very normal phenomenon, and we all get it. And nothing to worry at all. It's not epilepsy or anything.
It's a completely different thing, though, from restless legs.
Yes.
Yeah, when you say that to someone who has restless legs, they probably want to punch my lights out, huh? They say, I wish it was just once or twice, and that was it.
You're right. It's very bothersome. Imagine you've been on a plane, on a long flight, like 4 or 5 hours or so. And then if you've been sitting that long in the seat, you'll feel that urge to stretch your legs and get up. You know, and that's what restless legs is like. It's a sort of a creepy, crawly feeling. It's a very uncomfortable feeling, and it often comes on in the evening or at night, and it is relieved a little bit by stretching the legs or moving about a little bit, but the moment you keep your legs still, it kind of comes right back.
Do we have any idea, as common as this problem is, what causes it?
There may be, if you look at people below the age of 40, there is often a genetic tendency. It seems to run in families.
Below the age of what?
Below the age of 40.
40, okay.
Yes, yeah. And over the age of 40, it may be related to other changes in the nervous system that we don't fully understand.
And how do you make the diagnosis? There's no test for restless legs, is there?
So it really depends whether we're talking about adults or children. In the adults, very often the key features are there's this discomfort that comes on in the evening or at night. So, and there's a tremendous urge to move the legs. And this urge to move the legs is made worse by keeping still. And it is relieved partially by movement of the limbs. And so those are the typical features in the adults. So in adults, very often, the history is enough to make the diagnosis, and one doesn't really need to resort to sleep studies. Now, children is a little different, because children are not able to express the symptoms that they are experiencing. So in children, very often, we need some backup information, so we will use an overnight sleep study at times.
So you just actually watch them and see if you can tell by watching?
Yes, and when we do overnight sleep studies, we record the electrical activity of the muscles of the legs, or leg EMG as it's called, and that also gives us an idea whether this is happening.
When people start to experience RLS, do they have it every single night, or does it start once a week or once a month and then just start to progress? What usually happens?
Good question. It fluctuates. I mean, if it's mild, it may occur occasionally. But if it's more severe, it might start occurring 2-3 times a week or almost nightly. So I think it can progress.
What is a common treatment? What do you
do? Everybody who has it wants to know.
Yeah, what do you do?
So in young people, including children, iron deficiency seems to be a major player.
Is that right?
Yes.
They're not eating their spinach.
Yes. So I think spinach, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, these are good sources of iron. So it seems that low levels of iron in the nervous system affect the manufacturing or synthesis of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. So if you don't have enough iron, we don't make enough dopamine. Mm. If we don't make enough dopamine, then one might get restless leg syndrome.
So for kids, is it as easy as increase some iron in their diet and they can get rid of restless legs?
In the ideal world, yes, that's what we recommend. But lots of times, it's also important to pay attention to the diet and make sure that the child is really receiving adequate amount of iron-containing foods, spinach, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, as you mentioned. And the other issue, I think, is this concern about milk. You know, we've always heard that milk does our body good. Certainly, milk is important for the growth of teeth and bones. But milk, actually, excessive milk consumption might interfere with iron absorption from the stomach. Mm-hmm. So that's something to be aware of. And other times we may have situations where a child is on some antacid medication. And if they're on antacids for long periods of time, that can interfere with iron absorption because iron really needs an acid pH in the stomach for absorption.
All right, so what about adults? Is iron the culprit there?
Now, sometimes we've seen adults who have bariatric surgery. You know, for losing weight, they may get major surgeries on the stomach. And the iron is absorbed from the stomach and the duodenum, this upper part of the intestine. So if they don't have enough of a surface to absorb iron, so it could be a problem too in adults as well. But other times adults, it's just really low levels of dopamine, and there are medications available which are really approved by the FDA for use in adults, and they can be utilized.
Well, that's the same problem in Parkinson's disease, isn't it?
Somewhat similar, yes.
Yeah. Not enough dopamine.
Yes, but it may be that the dopamine deficiency in Parkinson's is a different side in the brain. And the spinal cord, whereas in restless legs, it may be at a different spot.
But that's one of the treatments for restless leg is giving the patient dopamine.
Dopamine-like substances called dopamine receptor agonists, yes.
Can you test for dopamine in the blood? Is it as simple as a blood test?
Unfortunately, no, because I think the dopamine levels in the blood may not reflect what's actually happening in the brain. So,
So is it an easy fix once you figure out why someone is experiencing restless legs?
Yeah, it's relatively. I mean, I think it's important to recognize that if it is properly diagnosed, the first thing, of course, is to try to fix the iron deficiency by supplementing orally with iron. And that seems to work, although there are side effects of iron one needs to be aware of, like constipation, etc. Sometimes they get constipated, they may use a stool softener to help them. Then making sure that the diet is appropriate. I think that spinach, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, these are important. Now, I was mentioning earlier about milk. One also perhaps needs to be careful about soy products. Soy also has phytates, which interfere with iron absorption. So I think one has to make sure that the diet is indeed balanced. And if the iron absorption doesn't work, one goes to the next step of using specific medications.
We're just about out of time, but are there any over-the-counter medications that help with this problem?
Certainly iron could be well, but I would not recommend medications over-the-counter unless one is really sure. I think one has to be careful some of the medicines actually, like Benadryl, et cetera, might worsen restless legs. So I'd be careful. It's good to get it checked out by the doctor.
All right. We've been talking about restless leg syndrome with Mayo Clinic sleep disorders specialist, Dr. Suresh Kodagal. Thanks for being on the program, Dr. Kodagal. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. My pleasure.
For more information, visit the Mayo Clinic News Network for today's podcast and previously aired programs.
Tweet your health and medicine questions to hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Rich Dietman, our social media editor, Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.